Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West on very short notice. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 333. Of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. You texted me 5 minutes before recording time and told me that we were recording.
Well, we don't. We have a standing engagement at 5 my time, 7 your PM on PM your time on. Every
and I
Saturday.
Went. I went and looked at the Google Doc at like 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock my time. There wasn't a stitch, and I was like, "Well, we kind of talked yesterday about maybe not, because nothing had come up yet." And now you're like, "Where are you? We're ready." Here I am. Are you ready?
Well, that is somewhat true. We did talk about possibly skipping, but then yesterday something broke from South Carolina, and I just couldn't help myself, and I started working on it, and I got it pulled together. But you should have been able to see it a couple hours before start time in the shared doc. But nonetheless, we're here, and we've got our vast audience that's actually shown up.
There are some people that are here, and they keep kind of trickling in just on short notice. I sent out a message 5 minutes prior to, when did I make the announcement? I think it was 5 minutes prior. 7 o'clock on the dot, I made the notification. So if anybody shows up, they got it right at 7 when we started. So you have a case from South Carolina, and anything else?
We have, I'm going to dissect an article about a presidential veto at the end of the Biden administration. And that's it for tonight. And Chance can't be with us, so it's just Mr. Gloom and Doom.
And you are going to live up to that moniker, I assume, in full swing, aren't you? Full form.
Well, I'm only the reporter. Why do you guys want to go after the messenger? I'm just providing you information.
I'm sure I could figure out some way to expand on that. Well, I do want to tell everybody, please. So. You know, some people are like, how do we listen live? In the show notes on every episode, there's a link to the Discord server. Obviously, becoming a patron, then you link your accounts and poof, you're in there and you can listen to us record live. That is by far the easiest way to get in there. And you do that over at patreon.com/registrymatters for as little as a buck a month. Then that allows you to listen to the show. And we have a whole slew of people in here on short notice that have decided to come along. And if Patreon isn't the way that you can go, for whatever reason that is, then please head over to your favorite app and give a 5-star review. You could also then share the idea that there's this podcast that talks about, well, you people. We haven't done that in a long time, Larry. You people. So please figure out a way to help us out and share the love and spread our message of this wonderful program that we are doing episode 333 on this fine day of March 1st. All right. And are you ready to dig into this thing like right away?
I am, but I don't normally look at who's in the audience, but I'm looking now because of such short notice. And there's one of our patrons from South Carolina. Now, how could that be?
Just coinkidink, I suppose, would be the way to pull that one off. Yes, there is a woman here from South Carolina. Well, she's not even like a, what would be the word when you have a plant in the audience? Not even a plant. I didn't say, hey, why don't you show up? Because we're going to be talking about your state tonight.
Well, we appreciate you being here, Amy. And we're going to have a detailed report about your Supreme Court.
Well, you have this case in here from South Carolina, from the Supreme Court of South Carolina. The name of the case is the State versus Jason Brian McSwain, decided on when? Good grief, man. What is that, like Tuesday, February 26th? When was February 26th? That's just like 3 days ago. The 26th. Yeah, Wednesday. Sorry, Wednesday. And I've read the case. I read it like, well, all day, Larry. I read it all day. And I cannot see why you want to discuss it. It's a loss for our brethren PFRs.
Well, do we only just do good news? I want to discuss it because it's news and it's informative and it's educational.
Let's see. Someone needs to do some analysis on my on our shows, and I bet you it's a good 90% is bad news, Larry. That's why you're the picture of the doom and gloom guy from that TV show called Pennyworth is what that TV show is. All right. Well, I can see it's another episode of Doom and Gloom. And I'll set this up. This is a case that involves a facial challenge to the constitutionality of a newly amended portions of the South Carolina PFR Registration Act called SORA. Can you describe the newly amended portions before I go on?
Sure. In 2022, as a result of a decision from the South Carolina Supreme Court, the General Assembly revised SORA to include a three-tiered system for classifying PFRs based solely on the severity of the underlying convictions. Those in each tier must register for a specific length of time corresponding to their tier, which they belong in, before they may seek removal from the registry. And that's the key. They have to register for that amount of time that's prescribed in their tier, with no opportunity for judicial review or an individual assessment of their likelihood of reoffending.
Now, McSwain, a former teacher, pled guilty to two counts of criminal sexual conduct with a minor in the second degree, and that's CSCM. So that's something criminal, something South Carolina, something? What would CSCM be?
No, that's the criminal sexual conduct with a minor. That's an abbreviation.
Thank you for clarifying that, because I'm not that smart. Gotcha. And then also one count of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. After completing a term of imprisonment, McSwain registered as prescribed by SORA. When he initially registered, SORA required him to remain on the registry for how long? His entire life. Now that that has changed and he has a path off, what now?
Well, you're correct. It changed in 2022, and the General Assembly made that change in the law to provide a different system because of a court decision we're going to get into in a little bit.
Would you tell me the name of that case?
I think we talked about it here. It was Powell versus Keel, K-E-E-L.
And now that he has a path of, what could possibly be the problem?
Well, he and others believe that the new categorical classification is arbitrary. McSwain now contends that the tier system and its mandatory wait times are arbitrary and unconnected to SORA's legislative purpose. And McSwain argues that the newly amended provisions of SORA violate his right to substantive due process.
And I know that you really love to go through the chronological changes to registration laws. Now, so what are we going to do here with South Carolina? Can we do that here?
Well, there's not a lot that we need to get into for purposes of this case, but previously, as South Carolina law existed, any person who had been convicted of any of the enumerated offenses on the list had to register for life, regardless of his or her age or the severity of those offenses, unless the conviction was reversed or overturned or vacated. And after Powell versus Keel was decided in 2021, the current system was developed. And at the time Powell was decided, SORA did not provide any judicial review for registrants to demonstrate their individual risk of recidivism and seek removal from the registry. And that was part of what the decision was about, that they had no means of going to seek removal from the registry.
Now help me out, though, because I'm confused. So I'm reading on page 2, and the court stated, in 2001, we held that the initial mandatory imposition of PFR registration following a conviction for a sex crime was rationally related to SORA's dual purpose, and those are protecting the public from those with a high risk to recidivate and aiding law enforcement in investigating PFR-type crimes. However, we found the lifetime registration requirement, which, at that time, lacked an opportunity for judicial review to assess an individual's risk of reoffending. And that was arbitrarily and wholly unrelated to SORA's legislative purposes. Now, why did they not order a process?
Well, they did order a process. They just didn't order, that's a great question, they didn't order a particular process. They said that if you're going to require someone to have somewhat of an impingement on their liberty for their life, you've got to have them provide a process for them to review it. But the answer is kind of simple. It's not the role of judiciary. They stated, recognizing the development of the judicial review process was a matter best left to the General Assembly, we declined to set forth detailed prospective guidelines. Rather, we determined only that due process required hearings at which the PFRs were given the opportunity to demonstrate that they no longer pose a risk to the public safety to justify their continued registration. And those hearings need to be conducted with, quote, reasonable promptness and meet standards of fundamental fairness. And people extrapolated that that meant that at any given time, you should be able to have a process to determine if you're dangerous. That's not what they said, but that's what people wanted them to have said.
And then moving along, in May 2022, the General Assembly amended SORA in such a manner that while there remained a possibility of lifetime registration for all PFRs, earlier removal from the registry was also permitted. How does that work?
Well, South Carolina SORA now includes that three-tier system for classifying PFRs, with Tier 1 offenders having committed supposedly the least serious crimes, and Tier 3 offenders having supposedly committed the most serious crimes. Under the new tiered system, Tier 1 and Tier 2 offenders may apply with the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, colloquially, S-L-E-D, to be removed from the registry after a certain number of years as a registrant.
And what was the required amount of time for that?
Well, for Tier 1 offenders, it's 15 years, and for Tier 2 offenders, it's 25 years. And what's interesting, as I didn't even realize this until I got in this case, but SLED must approve the application as long as the Tier 1 or Tier 2 offender, one, completed all of their PFR treatment programs that were required, and two, they were not convicted of failing to register in the previous 10 years. So that means if they were convicted of failing to register 11 years ago, that doesn't count. And three, they were not convicted of any additional PFR type offenses after being placed on the registry. And four, they have to pay a filing fee. And five, they have to wait at either the 15 or the 25 years, whichever is applicable to their tier.
And it appears that the removal criteria is already established in the statute. So what does a PFR have to do now? What do they have to prove?
Nothing. According to the law, it says SLED shall remove the offender's name and identifying information from the registry. The court pointed out that a Tier 1 and Tier 3 offender need not necessarily prove he or she has a low risk of reoffending in order to be removed from the PFR registry. Rather, he or she must merely satisfy the five statutory requirements that we just outlined, and including registering as a PFR for either 15 or 25 years before applying for removal. That is the key language that some refuse to believe. If you're a textualist, it states that one must register for that amount of time, regardless of any other considerations. And I know that probably 90% of the people in South Carolina would call themselves a textualist. So I don't know how you can read this and figure out you'd have a removal process available to you earlier than what the text says.
Now, I remember a mutual friend of ours from South Carolina who was emphatic that he should not have to register for 25 years because they did not charge him with his offense until 20 years after it was committed.
I'm not sure on the number of years, but it was a long number of years. I remember that as well. And he was a little bit disappointed, if not angry, when I told him that his theory was not the best theory because of the deference that the legislature has afforded in terms of how they craft the statutory requirements. And they crafted them this way, so I was not very optimistic about him going forward. Now, I don't know if it's the same attorney that he was working with, but this case is something that I did not see as a likelihood of it succeeding on the merits.
South Carolina does provide a different process for Tier 3 offenders. Now, my reading is that the burden of proof is on the PFR.
You're reading that correctly. Why don't you just fire me to do this all alone? Because you don't even need me here.
We've considered it. At our board meetings for FYP, we have talked about releasing you.
So you're correct. A Tier 3 offender must first wait 30 years before filing the motion for removal. And a Tier 3 offender must affirmatively establish by clear and convincing evidence that he or she is no longer a foreseeable risk to reoffend and that it's in the interest of justice to grant the motion for removal from the requirement of registration. I would say with that standard, virtually no Tier 3 has gotten off since this process has come into existence.
You've already been assigned a Tier 3. How do you prove that you're no longer a threat? It's really hard to prove something in the future that you can't predict the future with. That would be really hard to do.
Well, you would have to certainly have some very good psychosexual evaluations, and you would have had to have stabilized your life to the point that you look so solid that you have too much to lose. People don't understand this, but courts look at what you have to lose as well. And let me digress from something that's not in the script. If you are charged with an offense and they release you on conditions of release, which may require monetary post of a bond, or it may require a property bond, which is very common in the South. They look at what you have to lose. If you're established and well tied to a community, you might get a personal recognizance bond, even though it's a serious charge, because you've got too much to lose if you were to abandon what you've got. So that would be what you'd have to do, is show the court that you have done so well for so long and you're so tethered to the community that you have too much to lose, that your likelihood of reoffending is extremely low. But the state is still going to argue against Tier 3 terminations. I can guarantee you that.
And then following the 2022 amendments to SORA, McSwain was classified as a Tier 2 offender due to his convictions. That same year, he filed an application with SLED to be removed from the registry. Now, SLED denied his application as premature, noting that Tier 2 offenders were required to register for a minimum of 25 years before seeking removal, and McSwain had only been on the registry for approximately 19 years. 19 years. Wow, way to split hairs. All right, anyway, so I've heard you pontificate for years that attorneys should not file for a relief that the statutes specifically prohibit them by the plain language.
You have heard correctly. I've done that, and I'm still confused why attorneys seek relief through a vehicle that does not provide them that opportunity. There are thousands of attorneys listening right now, or will be listening. You have an invitation to come in and explain to me, to our audience, why you seek relief through vehicles that you're categorically, statutorily denied. Tell us that, because we have inquiring minds and we want to know.
So short of that, since I can't like pull one out of the audience right now, so what should they file instead?
As we have said so many times, a petition for declaratory judgment.
Now, McSwain then filed a motion arguing that he no longer posed a danger to the community. In the alternative, McSwain argued Section 23-3-462 was facially unconstitutional. Citing Powell, McSwain asserted substantive due process required that he and others similarly situated be afforded reasonably prompt hearings following their registration to discern whether they posed a continuing danger to the public and, thus, whether their ongoing registration was necessary. McSwain contended that the requisite wait times were too long and a categorical requirement to wait an allotted number of years before first being able to seek removal from the registry did not bear a reasonable relationship to any possible government interest. Now, what's wrong with that, other than it's a big giant word salad?
Well, nothing's wrong with it other than it's not consistent with South Carolina law, and that he likely offered no proof that he posed no danger to the community. The vehicle he was using, remember, doesn't require proof, so he wouldn't have provided any, because it's not the correct vehicle to argue these issues. Hello, you've got to use the right vehicle when you're litigating.
Is this like trying to haul a bunch of stuff in your little tiny Yugo car, and you should be using maybe a truck of some kind? Is that what you're describing kind of sort of as a vehicle?
Yes, he's got to use the right cause of action, and he didn't do that, in my opinion. And I think the court agrees with me.
All right. The establishment of a process to satisfy constitutional due process in the deprivation of a liberty interest resulting from a criminal conviction is best left to the General Assembly, and they have spoken on the issue in the context of this case. That seems to me to be the court avoiding their role.
No. It seems to me to be an example of incompetent representation.
Wow. The you court, weren't there. Shots fired.
The court stated, quote, this court has not been clearly convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the enactments of the General Assembly applicable to this case are repugnant to any constitutional protections of the rights of the appellate. And do you mind reading the next paragraph, please?
Yeah, sure. So on page 4 and 5, the court stated, this court has a very limited scope of reviewing cases involving a constitutional challenge to a statute. We will presume the statute is constitutional and uphold the validity of the statute unless its repugnance to the Constitution is clear beyond a reasonable doubt. We are not unmindful that this is a grave matter to overturn by judicial construction, an enactment of the General Assembly. All presumptions are in favor of the power of that body to enact the law. All considerations involving the wisdom, the policy, or the expediency of the act are addressed exclusively to that branch of the state government. But when the unconstitutionality of an act is clear to this court, beyond a reasonable doubt, then it is plain duty to say so.
Yes, and then you didn't read the next sentence, which says the party challenging the validity of the statute bears the burden to prove it's unconstitutional. And somehow or another, people can't understand that. There's no presumptions of unconstitutionality, just the opposite. It's presumed constitution.
Hey, just real quick, they said that in the court documents that they presume that the statute is constitutional? Because you say that all the time, and I'm like, how does Larry know that? But that's the court stating that directly there?
That's the court saying it over and over again. We read that quote from the decisions practically every time we cover a case.
The court stated that the tiered registration system furthers the legislative purposes in ways the previous lifetime registration requirements did not. As we explained in Powell, the former lifetime registration requirement was over-inclusive because it mandated the permanent inclusion of individuals with a low risk of reoffending, thereby diluting its utility to the public and law enforcement. Now, however, with the adoption of the tiered registration system, the General Assembly has tied an offender's relative risk to the public, as determined by the severity of his or her underlying crimes, to the length of time for which he or she must register prior to seeking removal.
And before I go into what else they said, now, I'm sure that people who don't like legislating from the bench would not approve of a person or a group of individuals wearing a robe substituting what they would like the law to be for the ones that they duly elected statewide, district after district, for them making the law. So folks, we've got to be consistent. If we don't believe in legislating from the bench, then we shouldn't ask for legislating from the bench when it's something that we weren't able to do through the legislative process. The bottom line is here, this was not the best proposal. That was better than the previous lifetime, but it was not the best proposal that it could have been. But the PFR community got what the legislature was able, what they were able to build enough support for. But anyway, they stated, the time period selected by the General Assembly, while lengthy, further SORA's legislative purposes, and McSwain has not established otherwise. The classification may be under-inclusive or over-inclusive and yet survive a rational basis review. The Constitution does not require perfect policies to achieve a state's legitimate interest. When a legislature has a choice of means, each rationally related to the legislative purpose, it may constitutionally choose any of them. Its choice does not render the others irrational. And that's what I've preached for years. Just because it's not the best way, and you can come up with a better way, if your computer can run something and say, well, gee, this would be a more efficient way, that doesn't mean it doesn't survive rational basis. It just doesn't.
They also noted the current version of SORA largely mirrors the Federal PFR Registration Notification Act, SORNA. Both SORA and SORNA have a three-tier system for categorizing PFRs, with Tier 1 being the least serious of offenders and Tier 3 being the most serious. Likewise, both SORA and SORNA set forth similar minimum periods of time for which each offender must register before they can seek removal from the registry.
They also observed, quote, in addition to the federal government and South Carolina, a majority of states, 26 by our count, have enacted either identical or substantially similar tiered systems of classification and mandatory minimum lengths of time for registration before permitting an application for removal from the PFR registry.
And I guess you are most fascinated with the aspect of this decision in that they cited the New Mexico Court of Appeals. Nan, do you want to dig into that a little bit?
Yes, they cited a case that was decided here 20 years ago, State versus Drug Tennis. That's 86 Pacific 3rd at 1050 through 1068, New Mexico Court of Appeals.
They closed by saying, presumably the unfairness to any who might present evidence that they do not pose a significant risk of recidivism is, in the legislature's view, outweighed by the risk that a citizen may be harmed notwithstanding such evidence. SORNA's message is that no chance should be taken, even were a PFR able to present evidence in an individualized hearing that he or she is integratable into society and neither a recidivist nor a current danger, since the risk of harm to society, no matter what the evidence, is still too great if expectations were permitted. Exceptions, I'm sorry, too great if exceptions were permitted. A risk the legislator simply refuses to take. McSwain has failed to overcome the presumptions that the newly amended version of SORA is constitutional. Is there anything else for McSwain after this?
Well, sure, he can ask them to reconsider, or he can file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, because this does due process.
Sorry, I couldn't resist that one.
Now, that's funny.
I wouldn't imagine that they would hear that one.
Well, I would pray that they don't take it if he did file a cert petition. This would be a horrible case to take to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So like you said, that's the only next avenue is, since this was the highest court in South Carolina, the next one would be to go to SCOTUS?
He would file, if it were me, if I was stupid enough to do this, I would file a petition for reconsideration, but that's going to go nowhere. And then after you've exhausted every attempt, then you would file your cert petition, which I think is 120 days to do that. And the Supreme Court, if they received a petition like this, I would hope they would deny it, because there's nothing here. This would be as bad as a case could possibly be to take to the Supreme Court.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, alrighty then. Shall we move over to this little simple article you put in here?
Well, it's not that simple.
This is from Courthouse News, and it's about a proposed expansion of the federal judiciary. God, why are we talking about this? This doesn't apply to us. It says, House Republicans said Tuesday that they are taking another crack at legislation which would add dozens of new federal judgeships to courts across the country, just months after a similar bill earned a presidential veto. But this time around, what was once a broadly bipartisan bill aimed at addressing crushing caseloads across the federal judiciary has become a partisan campaign, as Democrats accuse GOP colleagues of using concern for their courts as a fig leaf, concealing a more sinister effort to install jurists loyal to President Donald Trump. Now, what is the relevance of this?
Well, it's definitely related to PFR issues. The number of federal judges has a direct impact on how quickly cases move. You know, when you've heard people complain that there are constitutional challenges that are, when they're being made, we hear this: when is the court going to decide something? Why is the case taking so long? Because they languish for years and years and they drag on. That's the relevance, is that we need enough federal judges to do the work.
Now, didn't they pass a bill in 2024 to add judges?
Yes, they did, but former President Biden vetoed it.
And according to Representative Hank Johnson from Georgia, this bill and the way it has come forward is nothing but politics. Is he correct on that?
I don't think so. I thought I had these lines straight. That should be.
You do have them straight.
So let me fix that for our vast audience that can see this. This should be in my section. The judicial understaffing delays, getting emergencies solved, or Judges Act. That's what it was called. The judicial understaffing delays getting emergencies solved, or Judges Act, which until November, it enjoyed support from both Democrats and Republicans in both chambers of the Congress. It would have added more than 60 new judgeships to federal courts in a dozen states, consistent with recommendations made in 2023 by the U.S. Judicial Conference. Now, you claim that you're a big believer in the science. Now, I don't have the inside track into this, but if the Judicial Conference, assuming they're reliable and they recommended this and it was bipartisan, I'm suggesting that maybe politics crept into this.
So are you suggesting that Biden's veto was pure politics?
Yes, I'm suggesting that. The measure would have staggered the new judicial appointments in 6 increments over a 12-year period, ensuring that as many as potentially 3 presidential administrations would have the opportunity to appoint the new judges. So I don't understand why there was a veto.
Now, my interpretation is a bit different, though. The Judges Act sailed through the Senate over the summer on a unanimous vote, yet it languished for months in the House, where leadership declined to debate it until after Donald Trump was reelected in November.
Yes, the article notes that the House ultimately, that is true, that the House ultimately passed a bill, but without any Democratic support. How is it that the Democrat Party no longer supported a bill in November that they had supported unanimously across the other side of the rotunda just a few months previous, and based on a recommendation from the U.S. Judicial Conference? How is it?
Democrats argued that the GOP's move defeated the purpose of the measure, which they said should have been passed prior to the election, when the first president to get appointments under the bill was still unknown. They contended that Republicans only decided to take up the Judges Act after it was certain that Trump would retake the White House.
I say hogwash. It did not change the fact that Trump would have only been permitted to appoint a fraction of the total judgeships, since the legislation provided for the staggering of new judgeships over 12 years. And we agree that unless the Constitution has changed, that constitutionally he can only be in 1/3 of that time of the 12 years. Lawmakers from the GOP, though, have said that the delay in taking up the measure was merely a product of a busy legislative schedule in the latter half of the year, which saw members of Congress negotiating federal spending in the weeks between their August recess and the October break ahead of the presidential election. All of that's true. They had to keep the government running with a continuing resolution by October 1st, and they had a lot on their schedule. This was a factor, I think, in the delay.
Now, Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin similarly accused the GOP of breaking their promise to pass the Judges Act ahead of November's election, and said that following Trump's victory, they were itching to appoint judges to the bench who were loyal to the president. They broke their deal, said Raskin. They've undermined justice in the courts. We were willing to enter into a fair deal because we believe in equal justice under the law. Our friends seem to believe only in heads I win, tails you lose.
Jamie Raskin doesn't make a lick of sense to me in that particular quote. GOP lawmakers reintroducing the Judges Act countered Democrats' claims, pointing out that while Trump would get the first round of appointments under the new revamped bill, both parties will still have ample opportunity to install their own jurists over the next decade. It doesn't reflect a massive change, said California Representative Daryl Issa at Tuesday's hearing. Now, I think Issa is a Democrat, if I remember. Unless the Senate and the White House remain in one party's hands for over a decade, this is in fact, will be a piece of legislation that will reflect judges of both parties. Issa, who is sponsoring the revamped judgeship bill, also slammed the Biden administration for scuttling last year's version of the Judges Act. He's not a Democrat. If he slammed Biden, he's not a Democrat, so I have to withdraw that. he noted that before. He noted that he had never before seen a president veto a bill that had secured bipartisan support in both chambers of Congress.
And Biden vetoed the Judges Act in December, arguing at the time that lawmakers had failed to resolve key questions such as the allocations of new judgeships. The White House also claimed that the bill's move to create new judgeships in states where senators had not filled existing court vacancies suggested that concerns about judicial caseloads were not the true motivating force behind the legislation. Do you think that could be true?
It could be true, but I have no evidence to say that it is. But I guess it could be true. But if that's happening, what's happening on those particular states he's talking about is that the senators recommend if a president appoints federal judges that a senator from the state, and is usually the senior senator, if they appoint judges, they will not be confirmed. It's a longstanding courtesy that hasn't been changed. And even if it had been changed, the fact that the Republicans control the Senate, they wouldn't be confirmed. So there could be Republican senators that are holding up appointments that were waiting to see if Trump was going to win. So that could be true. But Congress has not substantially increased the size of the federal judiciary since 1990. So we're talking about 35 years ago. And that time, caseloads have ballooned. The current backlog stands at more than 700,000 pending cases, with many concentrated in just a few federal judicial districts. Legal experts have for years urged Congress to help with the crushing caseload of jurists by adding dozens of new judgeships, and witnesses invited to testify at Tuesday's hearing echoed those calls.
The U.S. Circuit Judge Tim Timkovich, a judge with the 10th Circuit and representative of the Judicial Conference, told lawmakers that the Judges Act would address what he called a severe staffing shortage on the federal judiciary. He argued that the Biden administration's justification for vetoing the legislation last year belied a misunderstanding of the facts.
I agree with Judge Timkovich, and I say it was political as well. Judge Timkovich noted that such delays also increase legal expenses for litigants and extend the time for which criminal defendants must be held before trial. Things are so bad that some potential litigants may avoid federal court altogether because of the resources or time needed to involve their cases, Timkovich said.
Would you explain that? So avoid federal court? Would they? Does that mean it would then be dropped down into a state-level court?
Well, if that jurisdiction was available to the state, some issues you couldn't take to state court. But yes, I would say that's what that means. If you look at the backlog in a civil case, like our district is one of those busy districts here, the District of New Mexico, if you file a civil case, since criminal cases are prioritized, you know that they're going to move very slowly. And you might just decide, well, is there any way I can get into state court a little bit faster? Or I just may not go to court at all because I'm going to be in court 3 to 5 years.
I mean, forgive me for my ignorance. Wouldn't state court generally be less punitive than federal court?
Well, on the criminal cases, but the I don't think that the real problem is as bad in the criminal side as it is on the civil side, because by statute, the criminal cases are prioritized. So it's people who bring constitutional challenges, you know, through 1983, and people who have the opportunity to go to federal court. Lawyers love to go to federal court with civil rights claims because they get paid. Be awarded a fee as a prevailing party. And under many state statutory schemes, although you may be able to bring the same claim under a state scheme, you would not be able to get attorney's fees as a prevailing party, or it may be optional. If I convince an attorney to do a case in federal court under 1983 and we win, we're going to get attorney's fees as a matter of statute. So, but I don't think it's a big factor in the criminal cases, but you can't take a criminal case into federal court unless there's federal jurisdiction as well. Everything that is against the law is not a federal crime. And that's what the people after the Rodney King protests and all the burning and stuff, they had a lot of difficulty understanding that on my conservative side of my friends. They would say, well, Larry, I don't understand. They locked all these people up in the Capitol January 6th, and they're throwing the book at them. And what about when then you were in Minneapolis or you're in the cities that were burning? They were tearing up police cars and all the stuff. I said, but there's no federal jurisdiction. Those are state charges. And they said, well, they ought to lock them up. I said, but again, the fact that you're mad at the Department of Justice under this president, there's no federal jurisdiction. And somehow or another, that went unanswered. No matter how many times I've said that, people say, well, they're making such a big deal out of January 6th. Yes, because attacking the Capitol is a federal crime.
I'm with you 100%. It's arguing two different points.
Yeah,
they seem similar, different, just in action, but it's two different places, two different jurisdictions.
If you burn up a car on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol, and it's a federal vehicle, there's probably federal jurisdiction. If you go to Albuquerque and you burn up a police car in front of APD headquarters, it's not a federal crime.
Now, I'm going to give you just the most simple example. I sat on jury duty. And it was a federal case because a woman was accused of shoplifting at the Air Force Base Exchange for $30 or something like that of DVDs, simply because she was on federal property. They brought a federal case. She was in there for federal shoplifting.
Oh, that's amazing, but I've heard of similar things.
Sure. Well, very well. Oh, gosh. Okay. Is there anything else you would like to go over before we head out?
No, but I certainly want to thank this massive studio audience that showed up on short notice.
On short notice. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate all of your support so very much. It's very much appreciated. Well, Larry, head over to registrymatters.co for the show notes. And you can leave an email, send me an email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. I forwarded a couple emails over to you earlier today that maybe we'll get to later if they meet the muster. And head over to patreon.com/registrymatters if you would like to support us, like I said, for earlier as little as $1 a month. You can join the Discord server and you can chat with us. And there are people in there chatting all the time talking about all kinds of craziness. There's a handful of channels to keep the conversations segregated. And I hope you have a fabulous night, my friend. And I will talk to you very soon. And have a great night.
Well, thank you. But you missed one important thing. Also, you can hear Larry sing if you come, because there's all sorts of songs been produced by our deputy, and they sound pretty good. Some of them do.
Did you hear the latest ones?
I did. I heard it. I really like.
Okay.
I did like Stand Tall. That came out pretty well.
I think I could play one. Can I get to it really quick? I like this one. I didn't realize you could hit notes that high.
I didn't either. And what's funny is that AI can do something that I can't do.
You did not need to give it away.
If I was doing that in real life, that would be hilarious.
It would be amazing. Well, thank you, Deputy, for all that you do. I appreciate the personal help you provide for me debugging computer stuff. Anyway, thanks, everybody. I hope you have a great night. Talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.